Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, where we discuss everything in the Hooniverse. Join us each week as we bring you news, rumor, and recap. And now your hosts, Jay Witten. You win this one, Internets! And Melissa Mazza.
We were playing fast and loose with the term.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing episodes that have already aired, as well as news that's public knowledge. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again. Have something you want to say? You can email us at gallifreypublicradio@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @gallifreyradio, or leave a comment on each episode at gallifreypublicradio.podbean.com. This week I'm joined once again by special guest Keir Hansen from the Nerdy Dirty Podcast as we talk about the explosion of popularity of Doctor Who in the United States. Hey guys, welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio. Once again this week, Melissa is not here. She's still dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. So, filling in, we have guest host Keir Hansen from the Nerdy Dirty back with us. How are you doing tonight, Keir?
I am outstanding, sir. Doing well, and the lights are still on, so not bad here.
That's always a plus.
Yep.
All right, well, this week we decided we were going to talk about, the boom in popularity that Doctor Who has gotten in the United States. You know, I mean, it's a staple in England, but it's really come into the forefront here. I mean, you can find Doctor Who merchandise anywhere now. It used to be just in little niche stores or, you know, specialized websites, but, you know, there's a whole rack dedicated to it in the Barnes & Nobles by my house, so it's... It's really blown up here, so we decided to take a look at that this week.
Yeah, it's something that's been always kind of interesting to me because, I mean, and I know that I explained this a while when we first started talking about Who over in the Nerdy Dirty, and even to a certain degree, going back to some of the first discussions when Who finally came around as a topic on the Galactic Water Cooler, was that I had been, as a lot of people, as a lot of American viewers, might have seen glimpses of classic or old school Who in years past and didn't really know what it was or didn't really get drawn towards it for one reason or another. But with the restart, and I'm very careful that I always phrase it as that, I do not call it a reboot. It is not a reinterpretation. It's just a restart.
It's new Who.
Yeah, you got old Who, new Who, was something that when it started to gain traction and started getting a more prominent U.S. broadcast spectrum, it took off. And it has been growing exponentially since that restart in the mid-2000s. And I was always fascinated by, is there something different about it? Or is it just a matter of the fact that we consume our content more readily and rapidly and broad stream now than we could have back then? Or, you know, what are some of the factors? So I figured, you know, that would be kind of an interesting thing to take apart.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you're right. I think that it's part of the evolutionary process of both American viewers and the show itself. You know, we've been going back and watching some of the classic stuff, you know, just waiting for the Christmas special, and it's a very different show. You know, the new stuff is, while very familiar when it comes to the theme of the show, it's drastically different. You know, obviously the special effects are, you know, leaps and bounds beyond what they could have done back in the, you know, in the 60s and 70s. And that goes a long way for storytelling because, you know, when we were sitting down and we're planning on talking about Caves of Androzani next week, I was sitting there watching that and they had the magma monster and it was just, it took me out of it so drastically because, you know, it's such a horrible special effect that it's fantastic, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's, but then again, you know, we notice that with a lot of things. I mean, we could very easily go back and say, all right, working with what they had, using the sort of playing field that they had at the time, from a props and Foley standpoint, from a film media standpoint in terms of what they were recording or taping to, in terms of just the degree of the other players in the sandbox at the time and the other shows that were being used as the yardstick of what was considered good or compelling television at the time. They were hitting all the points that they needed to. We've just, obviously, as far as consumer demand, we've raised the bar farther and farther and farther in most recent decades, and maybe just within the last 10 years. Because you could go see 2012, now you go back to 2002 and you're watching X-Files.
Oh, wow, yeah.
You know, go back and watch that now and see exactly how well a lot of those elements hold up, or whether you find yourself looking at your watch and thinking, man, this is kind of dragging a little bit. I'm really surprised they're spending so much time with talking heads and not getting back to the action. It's the nature of what we've been primed to consume right now.
Right. Well, and I think another part of it is the fact that, you know, we had the Monster of the Week style shows for so long, which, you know, is essentially what X-Files was.
Yeah.
You know, and then came people like, you know, Joss Whedon, who was like, okay, you want, you know, Monster of the Week shows? Here, look at Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It's a Monster of the Week show, but you've got this thread that kind of goes throughout the whole season. And that's what New Who has started doing, you know, especially with Stephen Moffat taking it over. Sometimes it's not necessarily a thread so much as a rope, but you know, it begins to do that, where it's like, I can enjoy this one episode. I can sit down and enjoy this one episode this week, but if I want to stretch it out, I can have a much fuller experience.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that goes a long way for the appeal now, because that's what we've grown to expect now. You know, Monster of the Week shows had their heyday, but people have moved beyond that. They're like, I want a little bit more to my story than just 40 minutes and then reset.
Right, yeah. But they are very careful at this point not to go too far with it. You know, we talk about other shows that we're kind of passionate about right now. You know, there might be, you know, your Walking Deads or your American Horror Stories or things like that, where they are so threaded that you can't miss 5 minutes. You can't go refill your drink or go grab a bag of chips out of the out of the cabinet without making sure that you've dashed back before the commercial break ends.
Yeah,
they're that dense and that carefully structured. I think you can recognize just within these last couple of seasons, you look at some of the Smith episodes where you know pretty early on into the episode whether or not it's going to be something that's going to be mission critical, if I want to use that phrase, or whether there are ones where you can say, all right, I might get some interesting little character backstory, or I might get some interesting dialogue that I can take away from it, but this isn't going to be one where, you know, the safety and function of the galaxy hinges upon what's going to happen in the next 7 minutes.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting going back and looking at the growth. And I say growth; it was more of an explosion of popularity. You know, when so the show was revamped in 2005. You know, and here 7 years later, it's pulling in, you know, numbers that network TV is envious of.
Right.
You know, BBC America was pulling in, you know, huge numbers in these first five episodes of Series 7. And, you know, you've got major cable networks and network TV that is looking at it like, where the heck did this come from?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think a certain degree of it has to be the fact that there are much thinner borders in terms of regional viewing now as a result of digital broadcast, direct access, on-demand access, that allows a much tighter window of availability for programs on either side, you know, whether it be going back to the UK or coming across. We've also gotten to a point now where British television, as far as the US mainstream viewing audience, we're much more receptive to a lot of the programming coming off the BBC or related networks that I think have, I'm not sure who you want to give the credit to, if you can give it to anyone in particular, about who's been greasing the wheels in that regard. But you think about the fact that, you know, we've always joked about the fact that, you know, you see a new program or a new program start to take off here in the States, and you joke to yourself, oh, okay, which British series did they rip that off of?
Exactly.
Okay, maybe that's just because they are taking chances or playing outside the box in ways that a lot of production teams and writers on this side have not dared to yet, or maybe they're just functioning on a level that for them is becoming okay. We're gonna get a couple series out on BBC Three, BBC Four, or out on Sky or whatever the broadcast format is over there.
Mm-hmm.
And over here, we're working on formulas. You know, we've got the sitcoms, the rom coms, and the buddy shows, and we've got to keep cranking those out. And then reality television, which we also stole from the Brits anyway. But
yeah, exactly.
But maybe that's just it's a matter of the machines are just running on different tracks right now, and we're starting to see the fact that some production crews over here, Angry Alien being one, and some of the others, that are going to start saying, okay, no, they have a model over there that works. We're not going to actually grab their programs wholeheartedly, like Life on Mars,
The Office,
and some of the, exactly, and then just pull them over here and recast them. But we see some of the chances that they're taking, and some of the ways that they are playing around with what we think the viewing audience is capable of accepting, and they're starting to follow suit, and I think they're having some successes with it as well. There are some bumps along the way, but I think, you know, you look at what Sci-Fi has been premiering as far as original series within the last couple of years, or AMC or FX and some of these, and they're really starting to become some really interesting independent, I want to say film houses, but it's not film, but you get what I mean.
Yes, yeah, the production companies, so to speak.
Who has benefited from that? Because now you've got a viewing audience over here that is really ready, willing, and very able to get a hold of British broadcast content. So if you've got a willing recipient and a capable recipient, and then you hand them great material or material that is getting better and better, well, in certain people's eyes, okay, I'm going to take it anyway. All the 10th Doctor fanatics are going to come screaming out of the woodwork. But material that is consistently solid, and then you've got a way that they could be able to get a hold of it. Again, and I think BBC America, as far as a broadcast medium, is still trying to figure out for themselves how they want to handle the release formats, whether they want to do it same day, you know, or I should say 0 day on that 6 hour delay, so that it's the same time bracket but same calendar day.
Yeah.
Or whether they want to, you know, because they've been toying with that on a number of series, or whether they're going to go the Sherlock route, where it's something that shows up months and months and months later than it released in the UK.
I tell you what, that right there was a horrible wait for me. I wasn't lucky enough to make it over to England for the viewing of that. I had to wait until it was on PBS, and the wait for that was excruciating. And you know, I remember when Series 7 was set to air, and that, you know, it was what, 2 weeks ahead of time, and we were still unsure as to which day it was actually going to air. You know, and just the thought of, you know, they're going to have it in England on, you know, X day, and we might not get it until a week later or a couple days later or something. And it's just, there's that initial, like, oh my God, what am I going to do? You know, it's the fact that they've decided to, with the past two series, release it same day, I think has been outstanding. And that, you know, you've got the pirated numbers were cut just exponentially from Series 5. Because Series 5 was on that delay. I don't remember exactly how long they delayed it, but it wasn't released the same day. And it was pirated heavily. And then Series 6 came out and they aired it the same day, and the numbers just dropped.
Right. Yeah, so, because there's the people that really want to get their hands on the content are going to do so.
Mm-hmm.
So step up and provide it to them, and they will come to you.
Exactly.
You can undercut the piracy. I mean, we've had this discussion on 1,000 different forums and formats and things, but it just goes back to it. People just want to be able to get a hold of these things quickly so that they can absorb it, appreciate it, and talk about it. They will be your advocates. They will help your viewing base grow if you put it into their hands, because they have now become, walking, talking, social networking advocates for the material that you're putting out there. So you want to increase your fan base, get it into the hands of the hardcore fans so that they can start talking it up and tweeting about it and getting into forum discussions and podcasting about it and so forth. And it'll just grow. It's proven itself.
All right, well, I want to take a step back and go back a little bit. So how exactly was it that you were introduced to Doctor Who?
I'm notorious for having a very, very sporadic memory. Short-term or long-term, it doesn't matter. And I'm convinced that a certain degree of that is because I've tried to remember lots of names and faces and phone numbers and things. The human brain can only store so much in its quick access. But like a Polaroid, I can remember going to visit or staying at a friend of mine's house, second grade. So that's putting us in, I'll do the math here. We're in the mid-80s at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Doug Herbeck, if you're out there, Doug, I don't know where you are. And we were messing around with playing with a combination box of Buck Rogers action figures, Star Wars action figures, and he had a couple of other Star Trek, because he was a huge Trekkie in second grade as a result of his parents.
Yeah.
You know, this was definitely a generational influence thing. His parents had turned him into a hardcore Trekkie. But whatever we were doing that day, everything stopped when he realized what time it was, and he kind of left me to be able to play around with my choice of the Greedo and figures and whatnot, because he was going to go over, turn on the television, flip to PBS, and there's this crazy-haired, lanky guy with a psychotic smile and buggy eyes and a 15-yard-long scarf running around with aluminum monsters, and it was just the most bizarre thing I had ever seen. I had seen Trek. I knew how to handle that because it was sort of a familiar, in terms of the cast, their behavior, their mannerisms, their speech, their accents, and so forth. It all kind of fit within comfortable grounds. This was completely, pun intended, this was alien to me.
Right.
And I asked him what it was. Oh, it's Doctor Who. It's something my folks and I watch. So I tried to take in what I could out of it, but I remember just looking at it and saying, "There's far too much that I don't understand out of this at age, be like 8 or 9, that I could possibly be able to just pick up and run with it like any other show." If it were something where you just turn it on, it was my first time seeing Land of the Lost or something like that, I'd be,
can jump into that real easily and not have to worry about it.
Mm-hmm. I could tell that it was something that was, certainly sci-fi related, certainly something that that felt a lot like some other shows that were on at the time, but were not... I don't know. There was an undercurrent going on, and maybe it was just the sheer British nature of it. But we had our Battlestar Galactica original series. We had our Star Trek, TOS and so forth. But this was definitely running on a different plane. Granted, I was seeing Baker on a couple of years delay, because this was, you know, by the time bring the episodes over onto PBS during the 80s and things, you were seeing the 70s. Mm-hmm. But and it just kind of stuck with me. And then later on, when I started getting the opportunity to be able to catch re-releases, distributable copies, typically on VHS and things in the States, it was Baker. He was the man. He was the one that whenever you were talking about Classic Who, they would put Baker in your hands.
Yeah.
And that's what you would watch. And there was some of the stuff when you get around to, you know, to Fifth and Sixth Doctor and so forth, where you might be lucky to catch something really obscure on a weird network late at night, kind of we ran out of programming sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it was always Fourth Doctor, which is, I think,
right.
You take the longevity, you know, and the amount.
Well, yeah, the odds of catching Baker mm-hmm. are greater than catching any of the others.
Right. But I think, too, in a certain regard, just the show itself really started catching its stride there.
Mm-hmm.
By the time his years came around, the production was getting a little bit better. And granted,
they were learning to stretch their 20 cents per episode a little bit further.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and I think that they were working with slightly different filming components, so the picture quality was improving in terms
yeah.
of, talk about something that you're going to watch on reruns. If you were trying to watch First or Second Doctor, it was painful.
It's a little rough, yeah.
Yeah. I mean the lighting, the sound quality, the nature of watching it is just kind of, you know, you think you're constantly, as you mentioned, you're constantly being taken out of the script because you're looking at it as, wow, this is rough. This is about as rough as TV viewing is going to get without going back to, you know, the first couple Honeymooners episodes and things like that. And that's kind of what it felt like you can't clean up the picture any better. You can't really remaster something that was shot the way it was. So, yeah, it's going to take a real hardcore fan to plod through that and gain some real value out of it, other than going back and saying, all right, well, there's some story elements.
Yeah.
There's some elements to establishing the universe that I want to get out of this.
Mm.
But as far as plot points and as far as dialogue and that aspect,
I think that you actually touched on something that was kind of key to what made this so difficult to get into at first, because honestly, that's, I came across this show the same way when I was younger. It was, I was sitting around one day, I was bored, I was channel surfing and, you know, little clicking the dial waiting for a picture to come in, and I hit PBS and I was like, okay, what's this? You know, and it was a Baker episode. It was actually, I remember now that I've seen it again, I can tell you it was Pyramids of Mars.
Okay.
And I was like, this seems really interesting. And it didn't stick for me. It wasn't until later on, once I started watching New Who, that the connection was made and my childhood just completely exploded in my head. And, but you know, that was one thing that made it difficult for me, that I couldn't really get into it, because, like you said, we had Battlestar, we had Star Trek, we had all these shows that were American-made, but weren't American in culture. They
Right.
were set in the far future, on distant planets, on things like this. And so while we had American actors playing the roles, they weren't supposed to be American. Where Doctor Who is firmly British and unabashedly so, where, you know, if you weren't from England, you weren't going to get 75% of the references they made.
Right.
So as a, you know, as a 8, 9, 10-year-old child in the States in the mid to late 80s, you're not going to be able to get into it like that. You know, now I can go back and, after having learned a good bit about British culture and the world in general, I can go back and see that stuff, and even if there is something that I don't quite understand, it doesn't make it difficult for me to watch it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's one thing that has helped with the popularity of the show over here, is the fact that we do have, you know, the internet and, you know, communications the way that they are. And the world is getting a lot smaller to where, you know, yes, England's a different country, but it's not this foreign land anymore.
Right, right. I think the average, you know, high school student or, you know, your man or woman on the street sort of thing has a better core knowledge of some of the cultural references that might come about in an average Who episode, or just in general, just the matter of, you talk about the shrinking world, there's a lot of crossover in terms of the films and television that are not necessarily science fiction related or things of that sort, but we've got a lot of just typical, you know, chocolate and vanilla programming that has a lot of, you know, an episode that's suddenly shot over in London, or there's long periods where you're in another you know, country location, and it's just kind of becoming something we're more and more acclimated to.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't strike us as unusual about the fact that, hey, all the cars are on the wrong side of the road. It doesn't click.
Yeah. I actually found this interesting thing on Pinterest one day. I was looking around and something caught my eye. It was just this little quote, and I realized how accurate it was. It says, I can't remember exactly what it said, but it's something along the lines of, I watch so much British TV that I have to remind myself to listen for the accents.
Yeah.
And I find myself doing that where I'm like, I'm watching Doctor Who or Torchwood or Sherlock or something along those lines, and I'm like, oh yeah, they are speaking in British accents, aren't they? It doesn't even register anymore.
That's where the token American in the show comes by and they stand out.
Yeah.
Like, God, what's wrong with that guy? Oh, he's a Yank. Okay, I get it.
Yeah, so that's really played a lot into this, into making this show more accessible for Americans. Not necessarily playing to them, but we can understand it better than we could, you know, 10, 20 years ago.
We're a more capable consumer, or a more accepting consumer.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that works not only on the cultural side of things in terms of being able to understand a little bit more of the crossover in pop cultural elements or things of that sort, but also just the nature of a sci-fi show. Mm-hmm. You think about where we are now as opposed to Classic Who and trying to work against something that was trying to be, it wasn't a kid's show. And I know people go back and forth, oh, it started out as a kid's show.
No, it didn't.
It started out as something that was supposed to be family programming, or programming that the family could sit down and watch. It was supposed to be non-offensive, but it was by no means really intended to be a kid's show.
And I think that's one thing that people tend to confuse, is that, you know, that there's a big difference between kid's show and family show. Kid's show is something that is designed to entertain children, and every now and again you might get a joke that the parents can laugh at too. Whereas a family show is something that's designed to where, you know, everyone can enjoy it, but it's not going to be offensive. It's going to be more geared for a much larger audience, but they keep the language and the violence and things like that in check so that you can watch it with your children. It's not geared for them. It's just not offensive, like you said. So,
and then we've got the fact that there's just more sci-fi related content.
Mm-hmm.
You know, within recent decades, I guess you could say, and the sheer percentage of it on the dial right now is profoundly larger than it was at the time. So you've got rather than something that's trying to get people and just grab onto a niche audience, now it's a matter of the audience is actually flipping over to the format or to the genre because of the fact that it has gotten. It's gotten so much, positive attention. You know, cover of Entertainment Weekly or mentions within Premiere magazine and things like that. So, you know, if they could do an episode premiere in Times Square, you know, and the cast comes pulling up in DeLoreans and whatnot. I mean, it's, come on. I think they've kind of hit the big time now.
Yeah, and I think a big part of the rise too is the whole onset of quote-unquote geek chic. Yeah, it's much more acceptable now to be into sci-fi shows than it was when we were growing up. You know, when I was growing up, Star Wars was everything. You know, and my dad got me into Star Trek: The Next Generation, and you know, there were things like that that I was very heavily into. And then once I made it into middle school and high school, I learned that that's not the kind of thing that you tell people. You know, you let them bring it up, and you're like, "Oh yeah, I've seen that once or twice," and you just kind of build to it that way. Now that's not the case. You know, Halloween was a couple weeks ago or last week. Yeah, something like that. You know, and we're out walking around, and my 10-year-old sees this kid in a Boba Fett costume, and he's like, "That is awesome!" And I was like, you know, when I was his age, I'd have been like, "Man, I can't believe he left the house wearing that. He's going to get beat." And it's just become much more acceptable to be into this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And
it's no longer the fringe.
Yeah, exactly.
It really isn't. I mean, it's at this point, it's part of the fabric, and there's other things that are now considered sort of out there. But it's not even, you know, geek chic is definitely true. The smart is the new sexy sort of thing. And the whole idea of, you know, what was out is in, but I'm pleased to see it happen. Obviously, we're all very pleased to know that what we had sort of, you know, held on to by our fingernails all these years and said, "No, you don't understand. It's really good stuff. If you just give it a chance." And now we've got other people around that are coming to us and saying, "So, what do you got? Got some recommendations for me?"
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I love that.
Yeah, and yeah, it's one of the benefits of it becoming so popular is it's getting to the point now to where we don't have to explain Doctor Who so much because that's I don't know if you ever figured out a formula for it, but it's not an easy show to explain without sounding like a complete raving lunatic.
I've had to try to give the 30 second or the 30 word synopsis of it a few times. It kind of happens when I've got a TARDIS on my office desk or, you know, walking around and people notice the tattoos or things like that, and they'll comment. And I'll say, well, it's a, you know, sci-fi show that has to do with a character that lives for a long time and is not human but has a love for humans. You know what? And I stop the conversation right there. I say, you know what? It's on Netflix. I'll give you a couple episodes you can watch, and you'll know within two episodes whether it holds you.
Mm-hmm.
And I stop explaining. They can see that I'm all, you know, that I'm all wrapped up in it, but I'm literally fighting for words to try and not dumb it down, but strip it down.
Yeah,
to something.
It's such a rich show that you really can't, and that's the problem that you run into. But like you said, I mean, the best way to do it is to give people a couple episodes, because you know there's a process that a Whovian goes through when they're first introduced. It's, you know, they sit down, they say, "Okay, I'm going to watch this, I'm going to give it a shot." And as they watch the first episode, there's a definite, "What the hell?" And then they're like, "Okay, I'll try one more and see what this is about." And so they sit and watch the second one, and they're like, "Wow, this isn't too bad." And by the third one, they're sitting there with a TARDIS mug, a sonic screwdriver, a bow tie, and 3D glasses saying, "Well, crap."
Yeah. We've just had some friends of ours that have just started wading through. You know, they sat down, they watched Rose.
Mm-hmm.
They watched first Eccleston, and the comment I got back was, "Is it always going to be this hokey?"
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, no. There's a reason why that episode, at the time that it was released and what that meant for the franchise, was written the way it was." Mm-hmm. You know, they had to sort of give people a bit of a refresher. They had to give other people a complete primer, and they didn't want to cheat either side of the viewing audience.
Yeah, so they had to give it that fast pace so that you didn't have time to sit there and pick it apart. Yeah, you know, they just wanted to be like, "Okay, let's give you the story. Let's keep going quickly, get you through it so that you can make your decision afterwards instead of focusing on, you know, why it doesn't make sense initially."
Right. So. But then the funny, we had the conversation probably about 3 weeks ago, And just today or yesterday, they were, a couple of emails volleying back and forth, and they were talking about having to go to the doctor, and they made an inside joke about who was going to be their companion for the visit. So I knew that they were sticking around with it, and I knew they kept watching despite all the poo-pooing that they did after the first episode or two. So it does get into the bloodstream very quickly.
Yeah, there have been a couple people I've been able to convert fairly easily. My brother-in-law came down for a visit, and he went to the gym to work out, and when he came back, I'm sitting watching. Yeah, I don't even remember which episode it was I was watching, just rewatching something, and he was like, "What the heck's this?" I'm like, no, sit down. I stopped my episode, and I jumped straight to Blink. That's usually the introduction episode that I use. I was like, "All right, just sit down, shut up, watch this." And by the time we got done with it, he's like, "Wow, that was kind of interesting." I was like, "Okay, pick one, random, just go ahead and pick one. I'll let you do it." And he flipped through, and I forget which episode he picked next. And 3 days later, I got a call from him, or I got a text message from him saying, "Well, I just finished with Tenet." And I've done that with a few people where it's just one simple episode, and they get hooked.
Right. Yeah. And that's good. I think at one point we're probably going to be able to put together the starter pack.
Yeah.
And it's going to have, maybe the one or two. I think you kind of do have to include early Eccleston there because of the fact that they did pay some very careful attention to re-educating the audience on some of the backdrop.
Getting you exactly what you need to continue on. Whereas with later on in the series, you would have to pick, okay, I need this episode to explain the TARDIS. I need this episode to explain regeneration. I need this episode to explain this, that, and the other. Instead of just saying, okay, here, watch this. I know it's rough, but get through it, and then you can go anywhere you want in the Hooniverse.
Right. Yeah. I think you could probably do that. I think if you really put some thought into it, you could probably develop a six-pack that was going to be the informative set. Mm-hmm. That could give you that could allow any of them really to jump up to maybe as far as mid Smith and be okay.
Yeah, I'm thinking one maybe two episodes of Eccleston. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say probably like you said, Rose, because it's exactly what you need. This is the outline of everything you need to know. Mm-hmm. Dalek is a good way to immerse you more into the story and get you up to date on what's going on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple of Tenet episodes, probably Blink, and I don't know, I'd have to think about another one, and then 11th Hour, and you should be good to go at that point. If you can make it through, through five episodes and not be interested, then there is no chance for you.
That's one of the great kudos to the entire Hooniverse itself, is that it's something that has toyed around with so many of the sci-fi and fantasy elements that geeks of every make, model, and gender love to be able to play around with, whether it be time travel aspects, whether it be alien races, whether it be the idea of eternal life or recapturing youth, or and all of these things and all of these underpinnings that we like to play around with. Who has played with them all and continues to?
Yeah.
And just when you think, all right, they've done just about enough, we don't really, I think they've pretty much beaten all of these horses into a nice pate, we put dinosaurs on a spaceship, and there you go. Now it's all new goofery again, and you can keep playing with it.
Yeah.
There are no rules. That's one thing they've been able to establish for themselves. They have so much flexibility in what they can choose to do because his capability to jump about or pull things together, again, I no particular reason other than the fact that I'm just doing it on the dinosaurs and spaceship. You've got Queen Nefertiti and a big game hunter from the 1930s, but you choose to put them together because he's got a gang.
Why not?
He's got a gang now. So that's That's one of the things that I always love about it is even if you're not going to get the real hardcore arc episodes where you've got some meaty stuff to play around with, and so that you can, so that the water cooler chatter the next day is going to be really, really intense. Mm-hmm. Even if it's going to be a disposable episode, you know that if it's going to be one, it's going to be fun. Mm-hmm. It's going to be sheer entertainment. This is popcorn television right here. Yeah. So,
all right. Now, I've got a question for you. With the rise in popularity, people are starting to look back into the history and gain some of the mythos that comes with it. And I've seen a lot of people lately starting to freak out saying, oh my God, the Doctor can only have 12 regenerations. If this is the 11th one, we've only got two more Doctors. What's it? And, you know, I know that, you know, this is BBC's piggy bank right here. You know, they know that. They are not going to let it die. Yeah. And so they're going to come up with some way to extend that. Mm-hmm. Now, if, you know, it can be done very well and it can be done very poorly. So how it's going to be handled is yet to be seen. What's your take on this?
Well, we've run into these sort of things where they have written elements of the Time Lord premise in long seasons past, not really thinking that they were going to be painting themselves into a corner in future scripts.
Right.
And they've gone one of about three different ways. And I think that this still applies with where they are right now. It's either you acknowledge the fact that you have that you've boxed yourself in, and you have to introduce an equally outlandish element to negate that. Okay, whether it be some sort of an idea that because of a hybridization of DNA or something of that sort, that it allows him to that he is no longer confined to the same restrictions as your typical, you know, Gallifreyan, creature or creature of Gallifrey. So there's one. There's the throw the sci-fi monkey wrench technique.
Right.
Secondly, is to just acknowledge it and say, you know what, that was something that we can't work with. We're going to have to take a left turn. But in order to justify it, we're going to have to claim that it was either a mistake or a lie or something earlier. Mm-hmm. That, you know, oh, you were told that because, it was to keep you safe. It was for your own good or for whatever reason. They'll come up with a justification.
Right.
But they'll turn it into an untruth. So that's mm-hmm. option two. Option three, never acknowledge it at all. Just plausible deniability and
just
look away.
Roll through and ignore. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that one, as bad as some of the other options would be, I think that would be the most controversial to be done. People would be in an uproar, and then as time goes by, I mean, initially they would pitch a fit. They'd say, "Oh, this is horrible," whatever, and then months would pass, and they'd realize, "Wait a minute. This means that they're not going to stop my show." And then the complaining will stop.
Right. But, well, I don't know. I mean, personally, in terms of which direction I think they would take, or you know, if it does actually fall in one of those three camps, or there may be other outcomes they could potentially do, I suppose. Yeah. I think the most likely solution is that they're going to go with the first. That's kind of the idea of saying, oh, well, yes, I know that's limited ability of regeneration, but as a result of this one trip that I took through the rift,
it's allowed me to my DNA just enough that I can regenerate indefinitely.
Exactly. I mean, because there was also just people were kind of a little confused about the healing of River's wrist.
Yeah.
In the Angels episode, you know, like, using up his regenerative abilities for healing, but he hasn't done this before. What?
Yeah, that's something I took issue with. But then again, you know, in series six, you know, you had River doing the same thing and using her regenerations to heal him after she'd poisoned him. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, there's your previous encounter of this happening, so it's not just something they pulled out of nowhere, but yeah, when you start to mess with the regeneration that way, it's like, okay, let's put even a bigger spotlight on it so that people wonder. It's, you know, my initial thought was, you know, are they going to be using River giving up her regenerations? Did she basically transfer them to him so that he can have X amount more?
Mm.
You know, and I mean, that could be a way that they go with it. You know, it could be that they just bounce regenerations back and forth the whole time. Who knows? But yeah. I don't know. It's, I know that it's not going to be an issue, that they're not going to say, oh, well, you know, they said this back when they thought that, you know, back on the, I think it was the second Doctor when they brought it up,
mm-hmm.
you know, or when they restricted it. It's like, okay, when you're on the second Doctor and you say, yes, we can have 13, you're not thinking about what happens when you get to 13 because you know you're going to be long gone by then. You know?
Right, right.
So,
well, but then you also, the whole thing is kind of, to a certain degree, the whole argument is kind of moot because there have been references long in the back in Classic Who about the fact that there were many regenerations prior to the Doctor as we met him in Hartnell.
I don't know, see, I did not know that.
Yeah, there, I believe it was a Baker episode where there was allusions to the fact that there were generations prior.
Hmm.
So, what does that say?
Yeah. And I'd heard somewhere, I haven't been able to confirm, because I never got an episode for the reference, but somebody had said that during the Third Doctor's time that something had happened and the Time Lords had basically, in to reward him for something, gave him unlimited regenerations. And I can't verify that. I don't know. It's something I'd heard, and I'm like, you know, you think that would be kind of a big deal, that they would say, oh, well, here's our answer right here, that, you know, I can't imagine that's something that just would have gotten swept under the rug.
Right. Well, again, as you said, there were times when they were writing elements into the show in the early seasons where they didn't think that it was going to have the longevity or the critical analysis of some of the decisions that they made in terms of their plot structure that was going to come back to bite them.
You know, yeah.
You just don't think of these things.
Well, I don't know. Hopefully we've got some time before that even begins to come up, so you know, hopefully it turns out to be a non-issue.
Yeah. I mean, they're still doing that sort of thing to us right now, just in terms of like giving us the, you know, you take a look at with Jenna Louise Carter and things, and having her pop up in the first episode of the season where we know we're going to be meeting her after the break,
mm-hmm.
and then it starts this huge discussion, and I bet Moffat is laughing all the way to the bank.
Oh yeah,
about the fact that he's completely thrown everybody into this heated discussion over, well, all right, if she's Oswin there, who's she going to be then? When, but when she comes, are they related? Is it the same? Wait, is this going to be like another Gwen Cooper thing?
Yeah.
Or what you? But again, it's turning the viewers into advocates.
Oh yeah, I've heard many, many different theories on that, and it just never ceases to amaze me how many different ways people can come up with to try and explain this stuff. I'm very interested to see what happens come Christmas.
Yeah, that should be a good one. And then obviously the fact that, you know, being typical BBC, when they say and the show will resume in the spring.
Yeah.
Spring. Oh, well, that's kind of a vague.
And if the beginning of Series 7 is anything to go by, then, you know, we'll probably find out sometime mid-March that it started March 7th, you know. They'll let us know a week after the fact. Oh, yeah, we already started showing it. Did you guys miss it? You know.
I don't think we're going to talk about the popularity of the show. They can't even have somebody walking out of their trailer, you know, in a new coat without it becoming, you know, a big deal.
Yeah.
So,
well, I found it interesting when we were waiting for Series 7 that, you know, here we were 2 weeks before we were supposed to, before it was rumored to air, and, you know, we still didn't have a solid air date, and yet we knew that Series 3 of Game of Thrones was going to come on, what, like March 13th, 2013, you know, it's like, how do we know that, but this one's coming up in like a week, and we don't, you know.
And you got to wonder from the studio standpoint, which one of those is the better approach? Do you give people a fixed date and have them just, you know, count down? Here it comes, here it comes, here it comes. Or do you keep them guessing so that they're just, and they keep checking back in? Is it now? Is it now? Is it now?
And I have to say that given the numbers that Asylum of the Daleks had, you know, that they may have done the right thing. I mean, the first run of Asylum of the Daleks had 6.39 million viewers.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the second highest out of the first five. The highest was A Town Called Mercy with 6.4.
Right.
But the closest after that was The Angels Take Manhattan with 5.86. So it's like, you know, clearly they did something right. If you had almost 6.5 million people that with almost no notice still managed to sit down Saturday night and watch that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
I think it's actually a valid model because then, you know, you talk about, you know, trailers and teasers really become teasers because now you're getting something where, you know, people get to see, you know, another 30 seconds or however long of this aspect, and they can promote it and they can push it and they can hype it and they can throw another picture out a couple days later and people get equally excited again. But that excitement is built on the fact that they don't know when they're going to get to open the present.
Mm-hmm.
It's like changing the date on Christmas and you keep moving it around. It's the 22nd, it's the 27th.
Don't give them ideas, okay? I want my episode.
Yeah. That one's a nice fixed point because that's got charity involved. They can't mess around with it because it's a
fundraiser. Well, talking about that, though, we do know that it is confirmed that, you know, well, obviously, it's going to be on December 25th. But we got some new information about Series 7B coming out this week. Primarily, the big story, obviously, is the Neil Gaiman penned episode, The Last Cyberman.
Yes.
So I don't know about you, but I am super excited to see Gaiman's take on the Cybermen.
Yeah, because of the fact that, for me personally, because that's the Cybermen have always been very kind of cut and dry villains. Mm-hmm. Their purpose is very very singular. The lengths that they go to carry that out vary, you know, from iteration to iteration. But they are singularly driven.
Yeah.
And Gaiman is the type to take things from a very unusual angle and force you to look at things in a very odd sense that that you're often not really prepared for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, especially, you know, take it on the title, you know, The Last Cyberman, not Cybermen, Cyberman.
Yeah.
That this is going to be some sort of a weird a go around on, you know, the all but one has been eliminated or something of that sort, or this one has been again kind of the idea that played around with this with the Daleks, broken away from the hive mind, so it's unable to communicate back, and you can get inside what's left of the human in its head, and that sort of thing. He could go anywhere he wanted with it.
And I mean they've toyed with that kind of before with, you know, the first time they showed up in New Who with David Tennant,
mm-hmm.
You know he accidentally destroyed the emotional inhibitor or something, and you got to see what would happen to a Cyberman if it could feel.
Right.
You know, and they kind of toyed with this throughout, you know, especially with Closing Time with when Craig was getting transformed into a Cyberman and defeated them with love.
Yes.
Sorry, I still don't you with that.
Yeah, that was well, you know, I'm not going to discuss it. We're probably in the same
They offset it with Stormageddon, so we're square in my book.
Exactly.
But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see them kind of toy with that again because it is a popular idea with these guys, but what I want to see is, you know, kind of what they did with the Daleks in Asylum of the Daleks. I want to see Cybermen as scary again. I mean, these are basically, you know, coordinated and militaristic zombies. You know, you can't stop them. You can't, you know, you might be able to take one or two out, but it's their sheer numbers that's going to get you. And because they're so coordinated, they're that much more dangerous. But because we see them get defeated time and time and time again, they become almost comical. And I want to see them be frightening again. You know, so I'm hoping that that's how this turns. I want to see the revival. You know, because Asylum of the Daleks did a good job of making the Daleks frightening again, and I want to see that for the Cybermen. I think it can be done. It just takes someone like Neil Gaiman to be able to pull it off.
I think so. In terms of being able to, like I said, push it in a direction that we weren't prepared for, he's going to be the one to do that. Whether he decides to go the really dark and ominous route, whether he decides to go and make it something where it's just sort of a psycho thriller of sorts, because of the fact that now we're getting something out of them that we weren't prepared for. You know what? He could do whatever he wants. I'm gonna absorb it, you know, giggling like a school kid the whole time.
Exactly. Just go ahead and start polishing and engraving the reward for him because you know he's going to get it. Well, some of the people that they've got cast for this, you know, they've got Tamsin Othwaite from EastEnders and Hotel Babylon, Jason Watkins from Being Human and Lark Rise to Candleford, and Warwick Davis from almost anything sci-fi related in the past 30 years.
Yes.
Willow, Star Wars, Harry Potter. He's been in everything. So the fact that they got him in this just adds that much more clout to it. So it looks like it's going to be an exciting episode.
Well, I think in terms of if you were to walk you know, an ideal British cast, you know, and you're optioning people or pitching people to be involved with an episode right now, I would imagine that there's an undercurrent among British cast or British film and television talent that would love to get walk-on roles in a Who episode. And then if you put Gaiman's writing behind it even more so. You know, now it's something where, you know, please, my agent will find me, you know, in the bathroom if necessary. Just let me know if there's anything I could possibly do. If I can just walk by a storefront window in the episode, that's fine.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
So.
related to this, they actually had the read through this previous week, and I'm not sure how reliable this story is. I did find it on Reddit, but apparently someone in Cardiff got into a cab and had found a copy of the script for The Last Cyberman. They're, as far as I understand, they're trying everything they can to return it to the BBC. They're doing what they can, trying to keep it out of public view, but they did take a picture of it and post it on the internet, because that's what you do when you're trying to keep it away from people. So that's how we know that the title is The Last Cyberman. Because I couldn't find it in any other news articles or anything, but it says it right here on the front. And just for people who are curious about this kind of thing, there's a side in this picture I'm looking at here. There's a page off to the side that has part of the cast. And, you know, they've got Matt Smith, they've got Jenna Louise Coleman, Warwick Davis, and they have the characters they'll be playing too. I won't go into to Warwick Davis's character because I want to leave that alone. But Jenna Louise Coleman is listed as Clara. So, you know, there's been rumor before, it hasn't been solidified yet, but. You know, here we've got what appears to be a solid piece of evidence to the fact. So, I'm just gonna go ahead and start referring to her as such, because, you know, with all the rumors flying around and now this, you know, photographic evidence, I think it's pretty fair to say that that's probably what she's gonna be called.
For what that, you know, adds or detracts from the
Yeah.
episode.
We still don't know if she's going to be the same character as Oswin or related to or what. We just know her name at this point. So that's why I'm not bothering to throw a spoiler tag on this.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, the countdown to Christmas being what it is, I'm going to have to fill my time with going back and rebuilding my Classic Who collection.
I heard about that. I was so sorry about that.
Yeah. And it's funny. It wasn't until about 2 hours later that I realized, oh, there were family photos on there. I was all concerned about, no, half a terabyte of Classic Who gone off the hard drive. I'm wandering around the Apple store, you know, rending my clothes and gnashing my teeth and wailing to myself inside my head. And, you know, and I'm tweeting about it, and all these people are kind of jumping out. Oh, sorry to hear about that. Oh, it's really bad. And then I stop for a moment and realize, oh, yeah, family photos. There was some original song material on there. I probably should be a little more mindful of backup next time. Let that be a lesson to you, kids. Backups are not just for your parents.
For anyone out there who doesn't know the story behind this, Kier actually had half a terabyte of Classic Who. I mean, you had pretty much...
I had the complete collection.
Yeah, everything that you can have at this point, you had, and wound up losing the hard drive on your laptop.
Yes.
So,
and I was actually, I had just formatted an external drive in order to do the backup for it, and I had it sitting there, and I just, you know, it was one of those things where I knew it was going to take a full day to, you know, to spin out the to an external, so I was waiting for like a snow day or something up here in New England to do that, and it didn't want to wait long enough. So
this affected me on a visceral level because I was planning on bringing my external hard drive in March to get that from you. So I feel
you. Oh, I'll have it back by then. I'll have it back by then. It's just there were a couple of holes. There were like the never broadcast episodes that took a little longer to get a hold of, and some of the, for some reason, I had a real hard time tracking down Fifth Doctor episodes and getting those archived. So
yeah.
I'll just have to go back and contact my sources originally and say, yeah, you know those VHS tapes that you thought you could finally put away? You mind digging those back out again for me? So,
well, it's about time for us to wrap up. So, do you have anything in closing, Kier?
Just for those of you who are budding Whovians or the hardcore Whovians out there that are starting to have the similar conversations from people saying, oh, you know, what's that blue phone booth you've got on that DVD over there or what have you, or what's that t-shirt me? Keep talking it up.
Mm-hmm.
Keep spreading it out there because people are they're ready, I think, more so than they have been before to be able to take on all things Who.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us again, Kier. It was a pleasure having you on.
Thank you. Had a great time.
And this has been episode 12 of Gallifrey Public Radio, and we will see you guys next time.
Allons-y.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week on iTunes or at gallifreypublicradio.podbean.com. Have something you want to say or just want to say hello? Send us an email at gallifreypublicradio@gmail.com or leave us a comment on iTunes. You can also find us on Twitter at Gallifrey Radio. You can also find our hosts at @_Melissa or at @Scopehound. Music by Dan Doodly Doo and Retcon Addict.